From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Kevin Gillespie is an Atlanta chef known for his love of pork and for his red beard.
I love Kevin's beard. It makes him just look so friendly and cuddly.
Have you ever seen the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer Christmas special? He looks like the Santa Claus from that movie.
There is apparently a Facebook fan page for my beard. It does not root for me to win, but to see my beard win Top Chef.
That's a clip from season 6 of the cooking competition TV show Top Chef. Kevin made it to the finale of that season back in 2009, and he was voted fan favorite. Since then, he's opened up 2 critically acclaimed restaurants in the Atlanta area, Gun Show and Revival. He's also released a cookbook. It's called Pure Pork Awesomeness, totally cookable recipes from around the world. I spoke with Kevin last year about his book and his love for all things pig.
So here's the thing that kind of surprised me about your cookbook. You really like pigs. I don't mean cooking them. I mean the animal. You seem to have a real love. In fact, let me play the song that you mentioned in your book here.
Awesome.
Yeah, but he was my buddy and he was my friend. Why? He was my breakfast every now and then. And he never done me no wrong or give me indigestion. Kiss a pig, hug a swine. Some of them are good friends of mine. I'm especially prone to those Hampshire porkers. I'm more fun than a dog and smarter than a horse. And you might find them a little coarse, but shoot, they ain't near as rude as some New Yorker.
So we're on radio, so they can't see you mouthing the words to this. That is Kiss a Pig by Ray Stevens.
I love that song so much.
You wanted a pig as a pet.
I did. I still actually want a pig as a pet, and everyone thinks that sounds really morbid.
Because
yeah,
you regularly
kid.
Butcher them and cook them.
I do. I don't know. In my mind, like, there's some separation. Like, I don't see that as an issue.
You have a great capacity for cognitive dissonance.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, I personally think pigs are great as pets. But tell me about what is it about this particular meat of all the meats? I mean, people tend to think, oh, there's seafood, there's meat, there's pork and chicken, but there actually is a huge variety of different meats. Why pork for you?
Absolutely. You know, it's for a lot of different reasons. I've always loved it. You know, it's critically important to traditional Southern cooking, and so I think that I grew up with a passion for it, and I always enjoyed it. My favorite dishes, for the most part, that my grandmother or my granny or my mom would make involved pork, and so I think I just liked it from childhood, but as I grew older and I was trying to figure out where this, like, country bumpkin kid fit into this fine dining world that I had found myself in, one of the connecting points that I had with the French and the German chefs that I worked with was that they loved pork.
Okay, so one of the biggest mistakes people make, I find, is either they put too much bacon in too many things, or if they're serving the actual pork, it's all dried out.
Right, right.
So what's the best way, if you are not if you're just a regular home chef, how do you keep your pork chop or your pork loin from drying out?
Well, see, that's the first problem is it's the mindset. It's like the mentality of how do you approach cooking pork in the first place. The most common cuts used in the home for pork are also the most difficult to cook properly. And so the tenderloin, for example, probably the single most used at home because it's small, it's easy, it's neat, it's a simple kind of preparation. It's also the most difficult to make well. And I think that people are setting the bar too high for themselves almost right out of the gate. They're not using the more forgiving cuts that would probably give them much, much better end results. Instead, they look towards that pork chop. And the second part is that they're buying that pork chop, for the most part, in the grocery store. And the reality is that even though we're starting to see a shift, even though we're starting to see traction towards better quality pork, right now, for the most part, the commodity pork that you purchase at the grocery store is a hybrid breed that has been bred to produce extremely lean and largely flavorless meat. And it's almost impossible to start with something like that and end up with a result that you're really going to be happy with. And that's just the truth of the matter.
So I made one of your recipes. It's the country ham breakfast strata. And for me, this seems like the perfect recipe for somebody who is, you know, I mean, it was easy.
Yeah, it's a very easy dish.
And very forgiving, I
Correct.
Thought.
Yes.
Here's the thing I really like about the way you write your recipes. I mean, you write them like you're standing there telling me how to do it. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, like, no, I mean, that's it, is that I wanted to take away all of the chefiness of a chef book.
Yeah, I hate the chefiness.
I agree. I mean, honestly, I think that, here's the thing, if I'm talking about football to another player, to someone who really knows the game, then I feel free to use a lot of the jargon and inside language that only people who have played it or people who are really in the know would be able to communicate with. By that same token, if I'm trying to explain football to, I don't know, my grandmother, I have to be on very basic terms to get the point across. And it's not dumbing it down. It's just choosing your language very carefully. When I write cookbooks, my belief is that cookbooks are meant more for home cooks than they are for professionals. I don't think professional chefs need a lot of cookbooks. That doesn't mean they don't own them. I have 1,000, 1,500, I don't know.
Really?
A tremendous, yeah, an absurd amount. But it's because I like the medium of cookbook. I think they're interesting. I like how they look. I like reading them. I think they're neat. But I don't know if I've ever actually cooked from any of them. I don't need them for that purpose. People who buy my books are usually people at home who do need the help, who want to have some guidance. And I think talking to them on a very human level and saying, look, this is what you need to do, and don't be afraid if this doesn't work, and hey, maybe try this. And by the way, like, once you own that book, these recipes are yours. They're not mine anymore. So do with them as you wish. If you want to change them, that's fine too.
Yeah, but you really do walk all the way. You know, there's a lot of cookbooks, and look, I love Jamie Oliver, but his cookbooks are like, throw a knob of butter in,
yeah,
and then saute until it smells, you know, crinkly.
That was a pretty good Jamie impression, like, because that's exactly what you'll get. And yeah. I love his books, by the way.
I do. I
love
own
the, like, Technicolor photography that you get from them, but it's absolutely, like...
But it's really hard to cook from.
Yeah, we actually joked about that, like, using the term plucky to describe, like, a flavor.
So the two restaurants that you own are Gun Show and Revival.
Yeah.
Now, Revival, I mean, we mentioned that's sort of using some of the really, what did you call them, down-home... country bumpkin stuff?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Revival is a pretty much like a half and half blend of the two very different types of, quote, southern food that show up in Georgia.
Uh-huh.
Most people probably don't realize it, but Georgia has a divide of two different styles of southern cuisine for the most part. And you could argue that there's three. One is the high cooking of the coastal south, or the wealthier sort of part of the state.
Okay.
My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, is old Atlanta money, basically. And their food is very different. It looks much more akin to, say, I don't know, continental cuisine or classic French, because it's a more elevated style of cooking.
And probably influenced by Europe.
That are more exactly, and very heavily influenced by Europe. My granny, my father's side of the family, are true hillbillies, like actually living in the mountains. Every generation, including the current one, and only a little bit of the family, basically my parents, have actually left. And so that food is very utilitarian. It's very it focuses on flavor above everything else, and it's not so concerned with presentation. Again, it utilizes every single piece of something. It takes preserving much more seriously. It's just a very different approach to that cooking. And then, you know, the other piece of it would obviously be what we call soul food, maybe not appropriately, but the food that is more akin to the African-American communities here. And you see a little crossover from that food into the high cooking of the South, because a lot of those people were the cooks for those families.
Yeah.
And so Revival really mashes those together, because I have a family that's half and half. And it makes for a very unique atmosphere in a restaurant, and it makes for a unique combination of dishes on a menu.
Kevin Gillespie's restaurants are called Revival and Gun Show. They're both in Metro Atlanta. His latest cookbook is called Pure Pork Awesomeness, totally cookable recipes from around the world. I spoke with him last September. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We spend the hour today talking about Southern cooking, and one Southern staple during hot summer days is watermelon. There's never a bad time to eat watermelon. It is succulent, it's sweet and juicy. Even though the peak harvest for watermelons in Georgia is over, you can still find them at the grocery store. The watermelon was once a symbol of pride for freed slaves. It has since taken on all kinds of racial meanings. I spoke about this with Pat Turner. She's a professor of African American Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. She's also author of the book Ceramic Uncles and Celluloid Mammies, Black Images and Their Influence. Here's our conversation from last month. When did the change occur, by the way, in between watermelon being something that Mark Twain praised in his writing and people just talked about a delicious fruit to something that is associated with a particular race?
Well, I think that the association of blacks and watermelons really dates to the minstrel era in the middle of the 19th century. This is the time period where the most popular stage shows involved white men dressing up in blackface and mocking and deriding black life as they perceived it in the South. They would exaggerate the size of their lips, the clothes would be sloppy and slovenly, and these stage shows became enormously popular, really through the end of the 19th century, past the Civil War, and there was a whole subset of them called Tom shows, which were modifications of Uncle Tom's Cabin that became musicals and were really popular.
And if the watermelon became part of those minstrel shows, why?
Well, food became part of the way in which popular culture could convey an image of blacks as savage. So any food that you could eat with your hands, watermelon, fried chicken, corn on the cob, these were the foods that were given to denote African-American characters as not having the civility that comes with eating with utensils.
This has become a controversy. Before we get to some of the more modern controversies, let's go back to the 1970s and hear a little bit of the TV show All in the Family. And in this scene, not surprisingly, it was his character, Archie Bunker, is expressing his distaste over integration in his neighborhood.
Archie, 12% of the population is black. There should be a lot of black families living out here.
Yeah, this is only a beginning, but I think it's wonderful.
Wonderful, huh? Well, let's see how wonderful it is when a watermelon rinds come flying out the window.
How did we get to the point where that became ubiquitous? Any ideas? Because we went from minstrel shows until we get to the 1970s, where you don't even have to explain the racist joke.
Yeah, it never subsided. And when I say minstrel shows in the 19th century, think about the most popular tweeters today. You know, think about when you think about popular culture, this was on the covers of sheet music, when sheet music was a primary way in which people communicated music. I have to explain this to my students, that before people even bought records, they bought sheet music because you played music yourself on your piano at home, the covers of which had blacks sitting on watermelons, spitting watermelon seeds. So it goes from one generation of popular culture item to another, all the way up and through All in the Family.
I want to play two clips for you, if I could. And we're speaking with Pat Turner, professor of African American Studies at UCLA, about watermelon and how it became a stereotype for a particular race. So in 2014, the Boston Herald published a cartoon, and the cartoon was actually about security breaches at the White House, but it featured the president, President Obama, brushing his teeth, and there's an intruder in the White House who asks the president, "Have you tried the new watermelon-flavored toothpaste?" That caused an uproar, and the cartoonist Jerry Holbert told WMUR-TV that it never occurred to him people would see that as racist.
I just think watermelon's a flavor. It's a popular flavor right now, and that I would go ahead and use it. And maybe this is very naive, and I'm sure that it is. It's very naive on my part, but I just don't think like that. And I really didn't think other people thought like that, especially up here in the Northeast.
So let's contrast that, a white cartoonist explaining that he never occurred to him to think of a watermelon as racist, with comic Phoebe Robinson, who says she avoids eating watermelon around white people. She's speaking here with WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful.
So I was in Whole Foods, and I was in the checkout line. They had, like, this thing called, like, watermelon juice, and I felt like they were mocking me. Like, I can't put that in my cart, because everyone who goes to, like, Yoga to the People will think that's what black people do. Right. So I'm like, I'm gonna leave that there, but I can't do it. Like, when I dated my ex, he was white, I dated for 4 years, I never ate watermelon in front of him.
When we talk about the watermelon as a symbol for black culture, is that something that there is a racial divide even on how we perceive that?
I think it can be. I do think that reporter was probably correct in his self-assessment that he was particularly naive. You know, if he's a professional journalist, I think he ought to be a little bit more in touch with certain things than that was indicated. But African Americans, many of us grow up being taught from our earliest days how to avoid conforming to the negative stereotypes that our parents and grandparents had to deal with. So the comedian had heard from her parents about the days in which it was far more ubiquitous and all of the things, and not eating watermelon is just one in an inventory of things. You know, don't be late and, you know, make sure your hair is neat and use proper English and walk proudly. A whole inventory of behaviors that are intended to negate any holdover of the negative stereotypes.
And you grew up eating watermelon with
a fork. Yes, my father grew watermelon.
But you didn't eat it with your hands.
Well, my mother, we didn't eat it with our hands around white people. We ate it with our hands within our own circle, but I grew up in a fairly integrated setting, so there were times when, you know, we had white guests. We were a little bit actually unusual, you know, considering it was the 60s and 70s. So there was a little bit more integration in my community than there is in many. But anytime there would have been a white guest, the option of putting watermelon on a plate and having a fork to eat it would definitely have been there.
But Pat, are we coming to the point, especially when we have to look back through history and go back as far as minstrel shows to trace this tradition, are we now getting to the point where this particular stereotype might be ready to die out within a generation or so?
I think it's possible. It's often hard to for stereotypes to die. You know, if you or your listeners Google, you know, put Obama and watermelon in Google Images, you will come up with lots of very contemporary cartoons making that association with him. You know, there's something very, very tenacious about stereotypes and about derogatory images that makes them very hard to eradicate completely.
That was my conversation with Pat Turner. She's a professor of African American Studies at UCLA. She's also author of the book Ceramic Uncles and Celluloid Mammies, Black Images and Their Influence. I spoke with her last month. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Let me ask you a kind of personal question. How do you like your barbecue? I'd be willing to bet you all have very different answers, and we all have different tastes. That's why. You'd think there would be all different kinds of people to write about the different kinds of tastes. But Kathleen Purvis is food editor for the Charlotte Observer in North Carolina, and she says the industry is too much the same.
For the last decade and longer, the food culture of the South has drawn attention from an often New York-based cadre of writing chefs and chefing writers like a mermaid perched on a red clay reef. And that writing is often focused on a male perspective that's starting to reek of hickory smoke and pig fat. Bourbon, barbecue, and pork belly, God help us, are interesting. I have loved those assignments. But in our rush to embrace those subjects, in our insistence upon putting them front and center at every discussion of Southern culture, are there other subjects that aren't getting covered at all? Try proposing an article on chiffon cake, or the contributions of Henrietta Dahl, who wrote the landmark 1928 book Southern Cooking, or household arts like pickling and canning, or the cooking of Mexican grandmothers. I'm glad the South has become so interesting to so many people. I'm delighted, mostly, when New York's hip-hop chef Eddie Wang finds his way to Oxford, Mississippi. I gladly joined the standing ovation for Monique Trong's love letter to Bridges Barbecue Lodge in Shelby, North Carolina. Those voices are rich and rewarding. They liven up the joint. It's just that sometimes I wonder, are female Southern food writers the only cultural group left whom it's okay to treat as tokens? How can you tell the complete story of the South without all of us at the table? When the assignments are pitched, don't relegate the female writers, particularly not the Southern ones, to just preparing the side dishes while the men fire up the pit. Don't just turn to us for the women's perspective, or when you want to read the history of cake. When you dig into the Southern food feast, there are plenty of ways to divide the pie. Just don't forget to give the sisters their half. After all, they probably baked the damn thing.
Kathleen Purvis is food editor for the Charlotte Observer. Kathleen talked about gender diversity. We wondered if all that holds true when it comes to race. Back in May, we asked some Georgia food writers to weigh in. I spoke with Nicole Taylor of the Hot Grease podcast, food and beer writer Dennis Byron, and Natalie King of the Chinese Southern Belle. I began by asking Natalie, who's an Asian American and also a Southerner, how well she thinks local food writing represents the population of Georgia.
Well, I mean, I think the writing, just like the food, reflects us and our experiences. So I use food as a gateway. You know, it connects people. It exposes us to place in history and culture. So it's really when I share about my own experiences and ask others to share and connect with food, it's really a reflection of us. And so since I grew up in Atlanta, and it was a very different place back then with no Asian markets, and I was the only Asian face in school, it has certainly become more diverse, and I'm very excited about that. I mean, now we have the Buford Highway International Corridor, and we have all this interest in different kinds of ethnic food. So I'm certainly excited about the movement towards
now,
that.
Now, that's interest in the food, and that's availability of the food. But, Dennis, does that mean we're getting a diverse enough cast of food writers that can appreciate all the different tastes?
There's always room for that. But I don't know if there's a word enough that says, okay, now we're good. There's 50% this and there's 50% that, and we're it's split down the middle. I think it's just what your profession is, and if you do a good job at it, then that will usually diversify itself, be it a good writer or what you specialize in. So, like, I'm in the industry of beer. You call me A.L. Sharpton, actually. Yeah, when I call my government name, I'm usually in trouble or something. But, yeah, A.L.E. Sharpton. And I see it. I'm working in the beer industry, and it's working on diversity, but it doesn't have to be pushed or forced. I just so people's taste buds are really complimented and talked about, I think that's a good start to do it.
Okay. Nicole, let me play you a comment from writer and restaurant owner Eddie Wong. He has a TV show called Wong's World. Many people watch. He travels around the world in that show. He bridges cultures through food. And this is from an interview he did for KPCC in Los Angeles.
I think the most satisfying thing is to be understood. At Bauhaus, if I make a dish and an old grandmother comes in from Flushing and says, you know what, I read about this restaurant and I love it, and it reminds me of Taiwan. That's beautiful. She understands my experience, and I understand hers. When people watch the show and they email me, I get emails, they say, I'm Puerto Rican, or I'm Ecuadorian, or I'm Jamaican, and I'm not just like you, but when I watch the show, I feel like this is my life. That makes me happy. That's why we do this.
What does it mean, Nicole? We've heard a lot of discussion about what it means to have representation, say, in Hollywood, in our movies, in our TVs, and recognizing faces that look like you and sound like you. Does that hold true for food writing as well?
Totally. I mean, when I open up glossy magazines or log onto the internet and I'm going to my favorite food websites and I don't see stories about my South and how I grew up in Georgia, I feel like, wait, hold up. You know, we contributed a lot to American food culture. Where are our stories? So it's totally important, just like it's in Hollywood or in music or any other industry, to have our voices, or more so our stories around food in media, in all types of media.
Okay. So, Natalie, I just kind of want to find out where those limits are. Somebody, the editor of Fusion magazine, tweeted out a picture of an article saying, here's the best dumpling restaurants in New York. And he circled the byline, which was Chris Crowley, who you assume is a white guy. And I think his point is that we often hear people who are not of a culture, maybe did not grow up eating dumplings. Is it possible that there are better prepared people to give reviews on dumplings? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, that's what's been frustrating, I guess, if we're going to be honest here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because I love the work that Nicole is doing. I think it comes down to how we're defining authenticity, who's defining it, and then who are we allowing to say, you know, what is authentic. And what has been a little frustrating in my journey is to see that these different kinds of ethnic foods are becoming popular, but they had to be first legitimized by the white dominant culture. Like some of the events that I've been to, you know, it was like, oh, you know, these are our family recipes, or, you know, we grew up eating different parts of the animal, or we talked about being connected to the land and eating a whole variety of food. But then it had to be legitimized first by the chefs that have the certifications, or they're from New York. And so that's been the disconnect that I've seen, is that there seems to be kind of the gourmetified, or I call it foodist, kind of elitist dynamic that's evolved. And like Nicole has written a lot about, you know, a lot of times it's reflective of the women that have slaved in the kitchen, or primarily, you know, black women that have served up the food, but it's the white men that are paid as professionals. And so I see that disconnect a lot with the new ethnic popularity of food, but at the same time, it's like we're...
It's odd to hear some guy who didn't grow up with that food telling you that it's not authentic.
Exactly, and then someone to tell me that I can't be authentically Southern. Like, they hear Chinese Southern Belle, and they're like, you can't be Southern. And so that dissonance is what is, I think, is an opportunity for us to broaden the conversation around authenticity, who's defining it, and who says I can't or cannot be authentic, or what foods can or can't be authentic. And as well as Chinese American food. You know, I mean, I've had people constantly ask me, you know, where can I find authentic food? And, you know, Chinese takeout must not be authentic food. But I'm saying, well, actually, it's part of the Chinese American experience. It is part of our Asian American history that Chinese food like chow mein and chop suey are actually authentic to us, but maybe not to someone in China.
We'll continue a listen back to our conversation about diversity in food writing in just a minute. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Let's continue to listen back to my conversation from May about diversity in food writing. I spoke with Nicole Taylor of the Hot Grease podcast, food and beer writer Dennis Byron, and Natalie Kang of the Chinese Southern Belle. I asked Nicole what stereotypes she's encountered as a food writer.
I think people always look at me and think, oh, you write about food, you're a cookbook author. Tell me about the fried chicken. And I'm happy to do that. But, you know, we are more than just fried chicken. And, you know, when you look at the African-American or the black experience in the South, it's full of seafood. It's full of all kinds of things. And you have the Caribbean. So, yeah, people do expect me to write about black food always. And I'm happy to do that because there are not a lot of voices or a lot of people doing that. But I do think there's room for me to talk about other things, not only me, other people to talk about stuff beyond just black food ways.
We would love to hear from all of you listening. Where do you go to read about food? What blogs do you follow? And does it matter to you? Do you look at the byline when you're reading a review or reading a piece about food? You can tweet us at OST Talk. My guests are Nicole Taylor of the Hot Grease podcast and Atlanta food writers Natalie Kang and Dennis Byron. Dennis, what difference does this make? It's not that, you know, just because you're a white guy, you can't taste good food or good cooking, right? Mm. So in the end, what difference does it make who's writing about the restaurants, who's writing about the cookbooks?
I think a lot of it has to do also with how much exposure a person gets, or a lot of magazines and websites that are, I guess, seen as legitimate, or a lot of them are white owned. So they think that those bigger magazines are the ones that make it a legitimate comment on what a good dish is, or who makes good, whatever it could be. And I think asking those people who do specialize in certain cuisine, they don't have to be necessarily directly from that country, but to know it and knowing their background, they can specialize in that way as well. It doesn't have to always be about race. But honestly, I had an interesting discussion with one of my cousins, and we're from Jamaica. And I'm asking him, what is the best Jamaican food in Atlanta? You know what I mean? And I'm taking his word a little more because he is from Jamaica. And I think that's one way to go about doing it. And also, American food sometimes is kind of tailored towards you know, not as creative as palates sometimes. So, like, maybe spices.
That's a nice way to put it.
Boring, bland.
Yeah. And, you know, Thai food can be kind of dumbed down a little bit to kind of not be as spicy. You know what I mean? Those kind of things. But you just got to kind of dig in the crates. And that's kind of a fun thing itself, is to find those really, really authentic spots that make the food that is reflective of the country they represent.
And here's, I think, would be a really big problem, Natalie, is because to a certain extent, you know, they always call it an educated palate, right? I mean, if you haven't grown up in a culture and therefore haven't grown up eating certain kinds of peppers and certain kinds of spices, it may take you a while to realize what it tastes like when those are cooked properly, right? But you don't get a second chance at that review.
No, I mean, you know, in the end, it's almost like if the food is good, you know, because we're constantly evolving. If you see food as an embodiment of the people and culture, as I do, you know, you have very rarely you're going to have a culture that is formed in a vacuum, right? We've got so many different influences, and the influences are exciting and tasty and spicy. Why dismiss it just because we might not think it's authentic, or because, I mean, I've been to China and it's been authentically bad Chinese food there, right? I mean, because we don't want MSG, we want healthy, fresh vegetables, you know, things like that we've adapted here in America. Or there might be Cuban influences or even Jewish or Spanish influences, and it makes it very exciting, and it's reflective of who we are in our cooking and what we've become as Americans. So, I mean, I think it's just an interesting, really dynamic kind of concept if you see food as being an embodiment of our diverse, you know, history. So I think to say, oh, because you didn't grow up in China, you know, your dumpling recipe isn't as authentic, or you are Chinese and speak Mandarin, so you can't cook a really good fried chicken and collard greens, right? I think we're going to be missing out, you know, on really good food.
That's
but
a great
at the same
point.
Time, you have to honor the traditions, right? Because, all right, to put bacon in sushi, for example, or to put something really kind of non-authentic, right, into a dish like sushi or in dumplings, are you being sacrilegious? Are you dishonoring that tradition? You know, and I think it's an important question to ask ourselves as people and for the food.
I agree. We have about a minute left. And Nicole, I wanted to bring you into this because it kind of depresses me to hear Rosie Perez say, would you ask an American, because she's an American? Maybe this is about just expanding. I mean, chop suey is an American dish. Mm-hmm. Maybe we just need to expand what American is when it comes to food.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I think that there are so many people, home cooks, restaurateurs, food writers, who are really doing great food and honoring the heritage of different cultures. And I just feel like there just needs to be a shift to those folks. And because I think people are doing it. It's not all negative. I feel like the last few months or the last year or so, we've been talking about the lack of, and there is a true lack of, but for sure, there are people who are celebrating our food in ways that totally uplift it. And I do feel like the tide is changing, and that we can move this conversation forward and move this whole thing around diversity and food forward if we just look at the folks who are not being talked about.
That was my conversation with Nicole Taylor, author of The Up South Cookbook and host of the Hot Grease podcast. Food writer Natalie King also owns the company Chinese Southern Belle. And Atlanta beer and food writer Dennis Byron hosts a video web series and blog called Cruisin' for a Bruisin'. I spoke with all three of them back in May.